Wow, where did all of you come from? How many people here, okay, let's just take a quick poll because I'm curious. How many people here went to bed before midnight last night? All right. How many people went to bed around like 1 a.m.? Okay, how many people went to bed around 2 a.m.? 3, 4. How many people are still awake from last night? Nice! Give those people a round of applause. All right. I thought I was going to be talking to maybe three people. I'm looking to see, are any of the people that I was partying with last night? Anybody that was at McLennan last night? One? Okay. And yeah. Guess everybody else is still asleep. They all said, oh yeah, we'll be there tomorrow. We promise. I'm like, no, you won't. And they're not. So good morning, everybody. I'm Nick Farr, and I'm here to talk about the future of everything. Just to give you a little preface of where I'm coming from, they asked me to give this keynote, I think, maybe a week before the conference was underway. And I wasn't sure what to talk about, so I asked Twitter, of course. I said, you know, I've been asked to give this talk about the future of everything. What should I talk about? And of course, 90% of the answers that I got back were 42, which is not very helpful. So I said, you know, instead of trying to come up with some grand unifying theme or organizing something really awesome, I'm just going to throw out 42 things about the future of everything. Unfortunately, for those of you who were paying attention earlier, I seem to have lost 37 through 42. So those last 37, 38, 39, 41, 42, six things will be crowdsourced. So as I'm going through these things, think of things to just throw out there, just a sentence, a word or two about something in the future of everything, and I'll try to talk about it for 45 seconds, which is exactly what I'm going to do with the rest of these things. The first sort of organizing theory that I came up with the 42 things that I was gathering throughout the course of the conference were, you know, the more things change, the more things tend to stay the same. Thing number one, in the future, there will still be bad code. There will still be bad memory leaking code. There always has been, there is now, and there always will be. Sorry. Two, one of the trends that we've seen, or at least that I've seen, I've noticed in my professional career, is that people in positions like mine love to collect data. They're just collecting more and more and more of it. They love throwing more sensors out there, more cameras, more report-generating demons, more things like that. They love collecting and collecting and collecting data, but they have no idea what to do with it when they have it. You know, the only really great example of an organization that's really good at collecting data, processing it, and spinning it back out in a useful way is Google, and that's about it. You know, even Oracle and all of these database companies that work in the corporate sphere are not really that great at pushing data back out in a way that's useful to everybody who's, you know, seeking information. They love collecting data, more and more and more of it, but they still haven't quite figured out how to use it. And the more data they collect, be it a national intelligence agency or a large accounting firm, they're still going to have problems doing something useful with all that data that they're collecting. Three, in the future, more and more content will be produced. More people will have blogs, more people will have their own web pages, people will start indie newspapers. The more people who become literate in the world, and global literacy is increasing, and because of that, more and more content will be produced. Unfortunately, the content will be crappier. That's just a trend that I think is unavoidable, that the more people who are writing, the more people who think that they have something to say, and the fewer editors that we have, as we lose things like newspapers, publishing houses, as content, as the marginal cost of content decreases and there's less money to pay people to edit that content and act as gatekeepers, ensuring the quality of those sorts of things, the quality of content will continue to decrease as its overall volume continues to increase. Unfortunately, lolcats will not die in the future. It will only get worse, along with other stupid memes in general. Five, privacy is a relic of the past. If you want to have this argument, we can have it outside, but I'm sorry, it's done. If people want to find out something about you, no matter what it is, given enough time and resources, they will find out what that is. The fact that they have many more tools to do so just makes, I believe, just reinforces my point that privacy is something people will choose to respect. It's not something that you have. It's not a right that you will continue to enjoy. That basically, privacy's done. Old meme, sorry. 6, hackers will proliferate. Because the world is becoming increasingly reliant on complex systems that average people don't understand, they're going to call upon more and more hackers to come in, fix, use these systems, manipulate them, and have people show them how these systems actually work, what these systems are capable of, what these systems are doing to our rights, what these systems are doing to the nature of our society. Hacking will become a competitive advantage. It will become a core competency. I was talking with some journalists about the cloud banking thing, and they tell me, you know, what's this, you know, why does hacking have to do with accounting? Hacking's going to have to do with everything in the future. And I believe hacking in general, as we know it, will become more important. Unfortunately, in the future, you're still going to die. There's no way around this. Sorry. And speaking of death, old memes. You know, as the old song goes, my friend Travis from Tennessee says, things ain't like they once was. 8, profanity, old meme. Profanity is going to go away. Instead of saying WTF, we're going to say things like, what the duck? Just a trend I've noticed. Arbiters of taste, old meme. The people who tell us what's fashionable, the people who tell us what kind of art to buy, galleries, the people who act as these gatekeepers who say, you know, this is what's cool, this is what's happening, all those people will go away in the future. Increases in communications technology, the ability of people on YouTube to go from, you know, absolute obscurity to people who are, you know, driving waves of 13 and 14-year-old girls to insanity in the course of 2 weeks. These sorts of trends indicate that the old arbiters of taste, the old arbiters of fashion, the old arbiters of culture and media are going to lose relevancy. That the power of each and every one of us to be able to influence how societies interact with their culture, to throw out trends there, what we wear, what we buy, what we consider fashionable, how we construct our identities, is something that's going to become something that individuals will have control of for a very short amount of time. And that I think the people who have acted like these arbiters of taste are going to lose relevancy as more and more individuals empower themselves and have impact over the culture. 10, context, in and of itself, I believe, is an old meme. What we're seeing right now, the big generational divides that I'm noticing, and I happen to sit, just because of my birth, in my birth cohort, I'm sort of stuck between, you know, the Web 2.0 generation, the kids that grew up knowing computers and knowing the internet and not knowing the world before that, and the people who, you know, maybe at one point had a home telephone line in the United States. That I'm noticing that the people who are a lot older than I am and the people who are younger than I am are separated by the fact that the people who are younger than I am don't require context for anything. They can take a lot of disparate information and data points and find the connections between them and connect them all together. The people who are older than I am, if you throw a bunch of random data at them, they're going to be confused unless you put some kind of overarching theme or some kind of context or something like that to it. It's kind of like the difference between the way a 12-year-old will tell a story and the way a 30-year-old or a 40-year-old will tell a story. The 12-year-old will give you all of the irrelevant facts right up at the front and maybe occasionally get to the narrative and occasionally create some kind of story arc or get to it eventually or completely lose himself and start telling one story and end up telling another completely different story. All of his 12-year-old friends will completely understand what he's saying. The 30-year-old will be lost in about a minute and 45 seconds. At the same time, 40-year-old will start telling a story. He'll sort of set things up and only throw out the relevant information that he needs in order to create this whole story arc, to sort of build tension and create sort of things. And unless he's a really dramatic storyteller who's very animated and excited, he's going to lose the 12-year-old in a minute and 45 seconds. Just something I've noticed. I guess that kind of answers that. Linear narratives, old meme. People love stories. People in that younger cohort that I was talking about love stories that don't have a fixed start point, have a fixed end point. Everything is in media res, and that's the way that stories are going to be told in the future. They're not going to be things that have a defined beginning and a defined end. It's just stuff that happens. And then the whole context of linear narratives, I think, is something that's going to be lost the more we go into the future. fixed realities are, I think, slowly going away and are becoming a thing of the past. Whereas perhaps at one point in time, when we didn't have to handle so much information, when younger generations weren't born into situations where they're handling more and more and more information, using things like attention deficit disorder, not as a disadvantage, but as a way of processing mass amounts of information that are out there, using it as an evolutionary advantage, like Tim O'Reilly said at eTech a couple of months ago. All of these sorts of things and mass quantities and pools of information that people are extracting data from to construct the realities are leading us to a point where things like fixed realities, where something is observable as the truth from people standing from two different vantage points looking in, is something that I think is going to go away in the future. And instead of two people being able to look at one point and arrive at essentially the same truth at it, people are going to be bringing in a lot more disparate information. And even though they're observing the same particular point or the same particular reality, they're going to approach it and be able to construct many, many different realities using the same observational data points. You know, what that means, fixed realities, old name. Newspapers. Newspapers are dead. Get over it. They're gone. How they're going to evolve is something that I think is really cool and really interesting, but the average daily newspaper for an average town that comes out every day and has a special Sunday edition is, I believe, a relic of the past. Of course, it's going away in major cities in the United States. That impact is slowly going to hit smaller cities as populations age and people who are used to that sort of tend to die off, as people continue to get their news from the internet, as people continue to generate their own news, that a lot of the really great sort of reporting and notifying the public of things like corruption in city government, corruption at the national level, things that people are reporting and observing from a first-person perspective, you know, maybe passing on to their friends that are bloggers, picking and having other bloggers, you know, pick that up, spread that out, and have all these sorts of things that used to be the domain of reporters who had a fixed beat, who knew all of the players, who could tell when something was up and would report it through a daily paper, throw out an article out there, then all the other daily papers would pick it up, fill in the context and fill in all of the other missing things. That kind of reporting is a thing of the past. Are we going to see more weekly newspapers, things like the Village Voice, things like the Stranger in Seattle, very specialized, market-driven smaller papers that come out on a weekly basis like The Onion? Yes. Are we still going to see things coming out in newsprint distributed to a mass audience? Yes. But as far as newspapers as we know them today, they're dead. Old name. The future is now. These are sort of things that I've noticed, trends that we can see and observe, you know, right now, things that aren't so far in the future. We can see, touch, and taste it. Is that me? Sorry about that. 14, voluntary surveillance. Quick little story here. There's this thing called Foursquare, and it's a site where you can check in to, I'm having a hard time explaining this, where you can check into various different places, where you are, find your friends, tell your friends where you are, show them little venues and places that you've discovered. The week that I've been here in Cologne leading up to this conference, I've been using Foursquare on my iPhone to keep track of and check into all of the different places and restaurants and venues that I've been going to throughout my week here. Foursquare, as it's sort of built and constructed right now, is only in a couple of major cities in the United States: Houston, New York City, San Francisco, Los Angeles, etc. I noticed a weird thing. I was just playing with it. I thought, you know, I arrived at the airport. What happens if I try to type the train station? What happens if I try to type in the train station, the Hofbahnhof here in Cologne, into Foursquare to see what would happen? So I go to the web page, I enter it as a venue, I load up Foursquare on my iPhone, boom, lo and behold, Foursquare thinks that the Hofbahnhof here in Cologne falls under, for some reason, New York City. And I thought, cool! So I checked in there. And of course, all of my friends in New York City said, you know, Nick Farr has checked into the Hofbahnhof in Cologne. And it just looks like another standard venue. And there were a couple of people who were on the forum saying, like, oh my God, dude, is that like a cool new club? Like, where is that? You know, where's the Domplatz? I have no, like, what streets are that near? I saw this and I just, I couldn't help myself. I kept going at it. And I think I've added something like 15 venues in Cologne that, because of this weird quirk in the Google API, if you enter in Cologne, or as it's spelled in German, D-E, you know, for Deutschland, but unfortunately, it's if you enter it in the two-letter city code in Foursquare, it thinks it's the state of Delaware, which allows you to pass it through. And then, of course, zip codes in the United States are five letters, postal codes in Germany, five numbers, five characters. Same thing here. It thinks that all of these places that I'm reporting in Cologne are actually New York City. And even though I haven't been in New York City in 3 weeks, I'm still number six on Foursquare in New York City. Long story short, these kinds of voluntary surveillance things, like Twitter, like Foursquare, the old, what was it called, Foursquare's predecessor, Dodgeball, people are reporting where they are voluntarily because they want to find their friends. They want to find people with similar interests. They want to find, they don't want to have to go through the whole process of actually meeting people. They just want to find people. The whole impact of social networking on our culture is leading people in that younger generation, the people who are the future, to not really care about the fact that all of these things that they're using are essentially ceding their right to privacy up in order to interact and facilitate social interactions. Privacy to people who are born after 1990 means absolutely nothing. They are telling you where they are, so that they can socialize and so that they can find people with similar interests in similar places at similar times. 15. Previously, ethnic identity was something that you were just assigned, that the government would look at your ancestry, they'd look at the racial composition of your ancestry, and they'd, boom, say, okay, you are white, you are Bavarian, you are German, you are French, you are this, that, and the other, blah, 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 blah. Well, as you know, the planet is sort of the divisions between what cultures are, what ethnicities are, what nationalities are, and these sorts of things are starting to crumble. People are exercising a lot more choice in who they are as people and their ethnic identities. That people who are quote unquote mixed race or who grew up in families from, you know, broadly different races are given the freedom and the flexibility to pick and choose different parts of the cultures that they inherited and construct their own ethnic identity. That being able to describe yourself in one word and assume one ethnic identity is something that's slowly slipping away into the future. And that at some point, everybody will essentially make a decision, you know, what race or ethnic identity that they want to assume. 16, terrorists are getting smarter. There are more of them and there are more creative attacks. This is just an entropic effect, I believe. That as the world gets more ordered, as people get put into more ordered structures, as we slowly take a lot of disorder out of the world, and as, you know, new world hegemonies through massive corporate structures, globalization, things like the European Union, as the United Nations slowly grabs more and more power in certain places, people will tend to feel disenfranchised. People will not be able to claim the kind of sovereignty that they want through their national identities, and they're going to feel like they have no other alternative but to become terrorists. And as more and more people feel disenfranchised and become terrorists, they're going to get smarter, they're going to adapt more, and that unlike before, whereas, you know, you could call terrorists sort of freedom fighters, that they were fighting against in order to establish a new one, terrorists are just fighting the dominant order, not with any idea of how to establish a new one, but just because that's the only way that they feel that they can exercise some kind of power and control over their lives. The nature of what a terrorist attack is going to get more creative. It's not going to be things like bombs. It's not going to be things like mass casualties. It's not going to be trying to strike fear in the hearts of people that there's going to be some kind of physical violence inflicted upon them, but they're going to start doing things like turning off the lights for 45 minutes. Because they can, just to show you that, you know, they ultimately have some sort of control or form of power, and that those kind of attacks that we're going to see are going to be more creative and are going to be ultimately more terrifying than the standard typical violence that we've come to expect from the terrorist realm. How am I doing on time? Okay. 17. The other good part of that, more democracy. As we enter an information economy, as people have access to more communications technologies, as people become more well acquainted with how these communications technologies work, it's going to enable more and more democracy, and that's a good thing. People will have the tools at their disposal to make decisions and make sure that those decisions get put in to the mass decision-making pool that comprises democracy in more effective ways. And that, I think, is really awesome. And in general, people in the future will do more with less. This is just an overarching trend that we've seen throughout history. It's a post-industrial thing, work 2.0, energy 2.0, materials 2.0. People will, because they have to, find more ways of doing cooler things with less stuff. The other thing that's you can't really observe as a trend, but is coming down the line, we've seen it in industrialized economies, the world population will shrink. As standards of living go up, people feel they need to have fewer children, things like birth control come in, people have other things to do with their times aside from, you know, procreate. And as we've seen industrialized countries, this will slowly shift into second and third world countries. The world population in the future will shrink. I believe that people who were born, you know, somewhere in the 1980s decade with their life expectancy will see a point where world population will peak and begin to shrink. Money. I think money as a construct, fiat money, will lose importance. You know, as we slowly shift away from industrialized goods and the focus of the transportation, sale, marketing, creation, design of goods and physical objects that require the sourcing of capital and sourcing of materials and money to sort of create and exist, those sorts of things will tend to lose importance. That instead of controlling capital and transporting capital and transporting various fixed things, people will instead put more value on information. That as the marginal cost of goods and the transportation of goods and the production of goods and the design of goods goes down, the information that makes these sorts of things more efficient is what's going to be valuable. People who have access to information, people who can process information, people who can find trends in the future, people who can tell you how to do things in a much more efficient way through being able to handle information are going to be the people who are going to have control over the currency, just like people who have control over money have it now. Being smart and being intelligent has always been important, that smart people have had a generalized tendency in the course of industrialized economies to be the kinds of people who become smarter, who are entrepreneurs, who have access to capital, but that sort of trend that we've observed in the industrialized economy and over throughout history is going to lose importance, at least under the construct of money. And people who purely have information, who manipulate information, who are good with it, while they may not be rich, are going to be treated and seen and respected as though as the rich, the people who just have money, are treated and respected now. 22, we will have to use less energy. This is just inevitable. We have fewer energy resources to call upon. We've extracted most of the fossil fuel from the earth that we can possibly use. Things like solar, wind, other forms of generating electricity, hydroelectric, these are fixed quantities. There's only so much that we can extract from our environment. And we have many more users. You know, as China, India, the rest of the world industrializes, as their standards of living go up, they're going to demand the same kind of energy resources that we in the industrialized world use. And as you know, we bring more computers and more different things online and have an increasing reliance on things that are powered by electricity, all of this stuff is creating a heavier load. Whenever you have, just in any system, fewer resources to work with, more users, and a heavier load, you're going to have to find some kind of way of doing things more efficiently. And I think we will. You know, that the amount of power that's used versus the kind of computing power that we have over time has shrunk dramatically. You know, just as more laptops have come online, lower voltage cores, different things like that, we will find ways of doing more with less energy. One of these things is sourcing things locally. Two trends that I've noticed, one, a trend towards local food. People have wanted and been more active about buying organic produce that's produced, you know, within 200 kilometers of their home. I know in Europe this has been, you know, done for a very long time, but as part of that whole cost of energy thing, we're going to be finding ways to not have to ship so much stuff around. We're not going to be getting all kinds of produce at whenever we want it, because if it's not in season here, it's in season somewhere in the other hemisphere. we're going to be seeing and relying on food sources that are produced more efficiently, produced locally, and don't have such high energy costs either in their production or transportation. At the same time, the second trend, rapid prototyping. Instead of having to buy cheap goods that are manufactured cheaply in China and shipped and have a high energy cost, we're going to see people fabricating more and more of the things that we use in our lives much closer to our house. Later in the presentation, I'm showing something about MakerBot and how I think that's a really big thing. But in general, we're not going to be shipping as much stuff to us. We're going to be making more stuff closer to home. And that brings us to tomorrow, just some more educated guesses I have about the future that aren't things that we can sort of pick out from the trend data that are right now. These are things that, you know, may or may not happen, just pure guesses. Everything up to this point, I think, has been backed up by pretty good data and looking at history and looking at trends. But a lot of these are just raw guesses. The MakerBot. This is the first really big, I think, public commercial venture to come out of the open source RepRap Fab at Home movement. This is just a straight commercial rapid prototyper. And I think that it represents the base of a very, very large revolution in the way that we do things, just like the Altair 8800 was, the first personal computer. This is the first personal home use rapid prototyping device. I think that 5, 10, 15 years down the future, we're going to look and laugh at the power of the MakerBot, just like we, you know, laugh at the power of the Altair 8800. But the fact is that I believe this represents a gigantic sea change in the way we do things. The ability to, you know, print massive amounts of document, to print airline tickets, to print our tax returns, to print all of these sorts of things at home, you know, as a matter of course, like we weren't even thinking about it, was something that people 25 years ago would have thought, you know, ridiculous, like printing your airline tickets at home, what? You know, they would have thought that ludicrous, but today I think the MakerBot represents something that maybe 10, 15 years down the future, the ability to, you know, print our own silverware, to print shoes, to print sunglasses, to print various different goods is something that we're seeing now and that's coming out of an open source movement. I think that's really cool. This is sort of a throwaway line that I took from somebody here, but the way to get females into rapid prototyping is to tell them that RepRaps make shoes. As much as that's a very sexist statement, I do think that there is a little bit of validity to it. I think that when you show people, when you just tell people like, oh, I have this RepRap and it produces cool 12-sided die and other things like that, people are going to look at you and say, nerd. But when you tell them, hey, it's a 3D printer, you can design pretty much whatever you want, and it will make it for you. And you know, there you are starting to play with different sorts of materials and showing them the kinds of things that it's capable of doing, and just sort of the promise of it. The whole promise of the RepRap project was to be able to create these machines that would duplicate themselves and print, you know, all these sorts of different mass goods that we rely on outside sources and high energy cost production to be able to make. And that if you tell people, hey, look, you can design whatever you want and it will make it for you, and this is something that's going to happen in the future, people are going to want to get involved and get excited about that. So, you know, I don't know if there are many digital designs for shoes out there right now, but hopefully by this time next year there will be. And this just leads into another trend. We will design our own things. Before, in the more pre or going into the industrial era, anytime we needed shoes or clothing or various different things, we would go to an artisan. We would tell the artisan essentially what we needed, and the artisan would produce whatever item it was that we needed, basically to our specifications, more or less. The promise of the industrial world was that we were creating uniform goods very cheaply that were the same thing that people eventually learned, you know, how to use and that they adapted to the technology at the time. I think the promise of RepRap and what we're going to see in the future is people taking not the physical object and perhaps modifying it or combining different mass-produced physical objects and making things to their own specification, but they're going to go straight from the design phase. They're going to figure out what exactly they want their object to do, They're going to design it, they're going to prototype it, they're going to test it in a virtualized environment, and then when they're satisfied with the design of that object, they're going to make it. And that this is something that, just like we use computers and write and email and design web pages and use content management systems like it's nothing, people in the future, people are being born now and in the next 5 years, are going to grow up in a world where they're used to designing their own objects. And then another thing, backup copies of our persona. This was something, I forget who I was driving around with, but we were talking about, I think, it was a different story, but there's another book, there's a novel out there called Everyone in Silica. And it's a novel basically where there's this world that people are essentially uploading themselves to. It's a completely virtualized environment. And people are leaving MeatSpace because this virtualized environment is so much cooler and there's so much more stuff that you can do there. I'm not sure that that will ever be possible, at least in our lifetimes, or at least that we'll be able to download our personalities into something and upload it into a system that's not a physical, real world. But I do believe that people with social networking sites, with Twitter, with the fact that they're throwing out so much content about their lives out there on the internet, we're essentially creating what one person called backup copies of our persona. That I think that all of the information that we're providing and throwing out there is creating patterns and creating distinguishing things that we can use and analyze and essentially create virtual copies of ourselves just based on the massive amounts of data that we're pushing out there and the massive amounts of data that are being collected about us. That if we were able to take all of that information, put it together, do some pattern analysis on it, and then perhaps apply some algorithms that maybe haven't been invented yet, we can create very good predictive copies of how we would behave under certain situations. And combining all of that knowledge together and perhaps merging personas and merging identities to be able to create and realize a lot of these machines and a lot of these predictive analysis textual things that will respond in a way that we might respond, just based on the data that's being collected about us and that we're throwing out there. So I think the ability to copy ourselves, at least from a symbolic persona perspective, is something that we'll be able to see sometime in the next 20, 25 years. Symbolic interactionism, it would take me 15 minutes to explain what that is, but I encourage you to Google the term. Essentially, it's a way of looking at, I mean, this is an incredibly simplified explanation, but it's a way of looking at the world that's not trying to collect artificial data to represent a pattern that looks at a certain point, but just basically looking at data from an anecdotal perspective and saying, just based on how you think about the stories of how people act and how people interact in society, to be able to draw the sorts of conclusions that we draw upon the collection of statistical data today. So it's symbolic interactionism plus plus. The future will be more modular. This picture is a picture of the bug. It's a portable computing device that allows you to plug in a lot of different modules. It's completely open source. You can make your own modules for the bug. You can do all sorts of different things, combine things together. It's essentially a blank slate for you to throw all sorts of sensors onto, throw out in another area. It's cheap enough that you can drop it in an envelope, for example, with a motion sensor on it, and essentially draw data on how violent a shipping process in one part of a supply chain is. And in, with the GPS module that you attach to it, it will tell you exactly at what points in the shipping process things got to be particularly violent. You can attach Wi-Fi to it, throw it in an envelope, throw it underneath somebody's car, and have it just automatically war drive for you. The point behind the bug that I noticed is that devices that can't connect with each other, that can't be taken apart to some extent, reconnected, or made into something else, are slowly going to go away. That the idea of a single monolithic device that does essentially one thing or a limited subset of things that can't be taken apart, recombined with other things that are similar, other things that follow the same sorts of standards, are going to sort of disappear. The one exception to this, and the one annoying point that I think we could point out, is Apple Macintosh laptops with many, many different kinds of video adapters. The fact that every single new laptop that Apple makes involves a brand new connector is, I think, strongly symbolic of how annoying devices that can't be modularized in the future are going to be. Everything is going to have to follow specific standards. Everything is going to have to work with each other. And these things are going to have to be developed in the kind of marketplace that open source software is being developed in. 30, Microsoft will continue to exist. They're a very large corporation, and they're not going to go away anytime soon. Most of the money that they make today is made from the sale of software. And a lot of those sales are not controlled. They're pretty much attached to the sale of computing products. That computers have to have some kind of OS on them. People aren't smart enough for Linux yet. And so they still have a market. That market is going to start going away. And Microsoft's going to have to figure out some other way to make money. And they're working very, very hard to find out whatever that thing is. What that specific thing is could be any one of 15 things, which I don't think is worth getting into right now. But the point is, Microsoft is not going to sell software in the future, but they're still going to make a shitload of money. This is another cool idea that I just heard about from Tim. Is he? Yep, right here. The idea of the basic income. This is something I think is really cool, that in industrialized societies, instead of making everybody work, instead of essentially enforcing poverty upon people who are unable to do some kind of value-generating income, industrialized societies should just say, hey, look, everybody makes a basic level of income. You just get that, regardless. By virtue of the fact that you're a person, your basic needs, the amount of money that it takes to provide food, clothing, shelter, maybe go to a movie once a week or something like that, is just going to be provided for you by the government. Most people are going to want more than that. They're going to want to travel. They're going to want to go to conferences. They're going to want to have nicer things. They're not going to want to live, you know, in a basic, small, little, tiny apartment. And so the incentive to work will still be there. The other thing is that this will start to appropriately price various different forms of really bad labor. People are not going to have to be forced to take crappy jobs. People who are janitors, people who are handling hazardous waste, people who are working at McDonald's, that a lot of those jobs that people take out of necessity will start to sort of slip away. And as the incentive to take those jobs, just because people need to have some kind of job to pay their rent, to eat, to do those sorts of things, that the pricing model for those sorts of jobs is going to start to increase. People are going to be paid more appropriately. And the demand for labor from places where people don't make as much is going to start to slip away. That if you want to really solve, at least within the EU, this whole problem of mass migration, people going from places that are a little bit lower on the economic scale, who are coming to places like Germany, Ireland, the UK, to take jobs that in those countries are considered minimum wage because they enjoy a higher standard of living. Instead, you're going to have people who are going to just have a basic income, who are going to remove themselves from the workforce, and then start to take these jobs that we're relying on immigrant labor to take, because they're paid at a level that's appropriate for what's in the marketplace when you remove the sort of necessity behind work. I think the basic income is a really cool idea. If you want to know more about that, you can talk to Tim. I'm interested in talking with him more about it in the future, but I think that the idea of that sort of basic income, freedom from not just oppressive governments and things like that, but in the future, now that we have more democracy and more communications technologies, and that it's the cost of a repressive regime is much, much higher now and will continue to get higher as people communicate, become more literate, and have access to communications technologies. The idea of freedom will be more along economic lines, and a lot of the things that Marxist theorists have been talking about for the better part of a century are going to come true. 32, space, the final frontier. It belongs to us. Just with things like the XPRIZE and the inefficiency of government-run agencies to continue with space exploration, the fact that we went to the moon 40 years ago and haven't been back since means governments in the realm of space exploration have failed, and that it's going to be hobbyists, it's going to be space enthusiasts, it's going to be hackers who are going to explore and conquer space. This isn't something that governments are going to be able to do. First thing about space is satellite internet. The more I hear about net neutrality and these arguments and ISPs becoming more restrictive, the more I think that hackers are going to find ways around it. One particular way, I honestly believe that we're going to have a satellite-based internet that people can't touch, that anybody can have access to, that will have an incredibly high bandwidth and be accessible from anywhere on the planet by 2020. Hobbyists are going to launch it. The kinds of people that are running ham radio satellites right now are going to be the people who are providing the technical expertise behind it, and that the notion of terrestrial-based internet is something that will go away and something that will be an antiquated notion to people who are being born today. Other thing, I'm a Seabase member. I strongly believe that they're going to pwn the moon. If you want to know more about this, look at the Open Moon Project. Google that. I think I'm running out of points. Oh, nope, revenge effects. Whenever you're thinking about the future, whenever you're thinking about implementing new technologies, whenever you're thinking about big, gigantic sea changes in the way that societies do things, you always have to think about the revenge effect. You know, just the law of entropy says that anytime you introduce more order into a system in one place, more disorder will be created somewhere else in the system. And that anytime you change the natural order of things, there's going to be some kind of revenge effect somewhere else, and you have to be aware of that. Water. One of the consequences of urbanization is we're creating these centers on the planet that are sucking in more and more and more water. If you look at the development of cities, cities were always built around rivers, around easy sources of water. And up until maybe about 60, 70 years ago, cities were never large enough where they were creating a much larger demand on that water supply than that local source is able to provide. Los Angeles. Los Angeles, in the post-war era, would not have been able to grow to the size that it has grown now without the ability to draw water from thousands of miles away. Unfortunately, Los Angeles' ability to draw water from thousands and thousands of miles away, as it continues to grow as a major metropolitan area, is being reduced. A lot of resource wars that we've seen in the past where people have maybe fought over access to forests or fought over coal or fought over major industrialized centers are going to be fought over water. You know, a lot of us, when we think of water as a restricted resource, are thinking about Africa and drought and mismanagement and things like that. Wars and conflict and violence over water is something that will come to the industrialized world. We are going to see it, and it's not going to be pretty. Another problem with this is that because of certain cultural aspects, again, and I'm looking at Los Angeles, there's this notion of toilet to tap. People don't want to have and fight any kind of water system that takes fresh water that is essentially waste, be that waste from standard drainage systems or sewage systems. They can't think of the possibilities of using technology to fix and clean that water and pipe it back into the water supply. Right now, Los Angeles, other major cities, are flushing all of that fresh water out into the ocean, where it becomes salt water, and just wait for that salt water to evaporate, come up over, you know, land, fall as snow in mountains somewhere, fall as rain in reservoirs, and come back down and slowly filter out, when really we have the technology to much more efficiently clean that water, put it back out in the water supply. But the fact that people have a sort of cultural, you know, a visceral reaction to the fact that that can't happen, are resisting those kind of technologies, are shooting themselves in the foot. 36. Unfortunately, one of the side effects that we observed during the Bush administration was that people, when they start losing control of things, when their lives start being controlled by more complex systems, when people who might not have the ability or the wherewithal or the cultural presence to try to understand the systems that manipulate and control their lives, people will find something else. People will become more spiritual. That the louder, I think, we see a lot of the voices towards a lack of faith in God, or the louder that we see people actually preaching atheism, not people who are arriving at atheism because they've had bad experiences with religion or because they, you know, are logical people who can't see God in a scientific construct. We're seeing people actually preach sort of atheism, and the revenge effect of that sort of thing, the revenge effect of people who believe that there's a gigantic conflict between science and religion, are going to lead people who are disenfranchised with society to become more spiritual or seek something else or seek something that cannot be explained, seek that sort of faith that by default has a little bit of doubt in it in a world who's trying to create certainty. This will have good aims and it'll have bad aims. People who are spiritual, people who are religious, tend to be benevolent, either for the sake of a reward in the afterlife or because that's the practice of what the religion calls upon. And of course, we're also going to see this in the negative side, is that people will assume that because they're spiritual, that because they have this quote-unquote connection to God, that God is speaking through them and God is telling them to do awful things like crash planes into buildings. Just a trend that I think we're going to see more of. And I think 37 through 42, I was just going to crowdsource. So 37, somebody throw something out there about the future. I'm serious. I mean, huh? Androids, okay. Zombie robots. All right, hold on, we've got a microphone. Zombie robots, pass this back to him. You've got 30 seconds to talk about zombie robots. Zombie androids.
Only zombie robots, it's radioactive mutant vampire zombie robots from outer space.
Okay, that's point 38. Let him talk about 37.
I believe that in the future we will see more complex systems that are actually going to walk amongst us, like as you've seen the bug is already a pretty complex system where you can just track your packages and how nicely it has been treated, and it's not going to be impossible that that bug is going to in real time report back to us what happened to our package. Now that's just a small bug, but in future we will see androids actually talking to us.
Excellent. Okay, we had point 38 over here, something about outer space, but I forgot what it was. Okay, specifically just so I can get the name of the slide correct.
It was radioactive mutant vampire zombies, robot zombies from outer space. I don't believe it.
All right, 30 seconds about radioactive mutant vampire robot zombies from outer space.
Woo!
Okay. Now, I think point 39 was, will we have children with them? Okay. does anybody have, well, actually, perhaps questions will arrive at 39 through 42 with questions. I do have, actually, I believe, 8 minutes left. Yeah.
Future of warfare. We see a lot of asymmetric conflicts nowadays. If you look to Afghanistan, Pakistan, the Gaza Strip, and so on. And you gave us an interesting theory about terrorism. And regular forces would call their opponents terrorists, whilst they themselves would call freedom fighters. So what do you think is the future of warfare? Will we see more asymmetric conflicts? And how will conflicts will be solved in the future?
There's a notion that leads to that point about this thing called permanent warfare, that because you have cultural conflicts and things like that are so entrenched and insolvable, and the powers are so asymmetric, you have large industrialized armies that have the ability to bomb people into the Stone Age, whereas people who are living in the Stone Age and somehow continuing to fight and thrive for whatever reason against these large Goliaths, but you see no permanent solution, at least in conventional warfare. Like we saw in World War II, you had massive industrialized economies pouring all of their industrial resources into going to war with each other, and eventually, for whatever reason, one economy won out over another. And as a whole, when you have an entire nation going to war, eventually, within 5 to 10 years, they're going to tire of it. Even in Western democracies, we see people tiring of colonial-style wars, and that people are gradually saying, no, look, we don't want to have anything to do with this. But because of asymmetric conflict and because of a generalized inability of people to resolve certain things and certain conflicts, and an inability for villagers in Afghanistan to see how that their political infrastructure is creating a breeding ground for terrorists that causes people to fly planes into buildings. And at the same time, a failure of the people who are working in those buildings that planes might be flown into to see how, the fact that they're creating a war that's essentially turning these villagers in Afghanistan into very good breeding ground for terrorists, the inability of people to see and reconcile those cultural differences is going to continue to lead to that permanent warfare that's asymmetric that we're talking about now. Whether there's a solution behind it, I hope we come up with one, but I can't see one right now.
Well, I had a total different point.
Go for it. Run with it.
Okay. Digital drugs will become available. They will be enlightening, but data integrity will become more important with that, too.
Say that again. I didn't hear it, Simon.
Digital drugs will become available. They will be enlightening, but data integrity will become a more important issue with that, too.
Sounds like a good point. Do we have, wow, okay. I agree. I don't really have anything more than that. Point 40.
I think we actually see the final goodbye to the idea that risk can be managed. The
world's getting... give him a huge round of applause.
The world getting more and more complicated, and systems are getting more intertwined and interacting with each other. We're more and more in that country that Nicholas Nassim Taleb in his Black Swan book called Extremistan, and I think we're going to get used to the idea after all.
I could not possibly agree more that the... I can't really find the right word for it, but just the sheer stupidity to think that humans could play God and could quantifiably measure every possible risk and create a lot of these false sorts of things that led to our current economic downturn, that just the abject and ridiculous pride that people thought of that they could create a lot of these systems were based on such key core flawed assumptions that changed as the nature of the system got huge. The fact that we think that we have this massive ability to control our environment is absolutely false. And the more power that we can push over or think that we have over our environment, and the more power that we give a lot of these smaller institutions, the greater the revenge effect is going to be. Whether you're talking about massively complex financial systems or massively complex environmental systems, major cities drawing water from thousands of miles away, the more power you exercise over any system, the greater ability you give that system to exercise power over you. It's just the law of entropy, which I think applies to everything. Point 41, which I'm going to put there. All right, and now finally, because I knew I wanted to come up with 42 points, point 42 is? Yes.
The day will have 48 hours, at least. It's more a question, because I was wondering how will people deal. You said crowdsourcing works, but still you were talking about so much things we will be able to do, and I think it was a lot about individualization of products, and I think it will become a problem to have the time to do this. We may not have the problem to with materials, but time will not become more with digitalization.
Okay.
I think that's a valid point, but and actually there's another side point to that, but to address what you were saying, I do think, yeah, we do have a finite amount of time, but just the way that we're changing, the way that younger generations are dealing with massive quantities of data and just intrinsically finding patterns in those massive quantities of data, I think shows that we are evolving and doing more and processing more information in the same amount of time. We're doing more with less. And we're also coming up with very good compensating mechanisms, you know, for those of us who aren't, you know, 15, 16, 17, 18 years old anymore. I love Club Mata. And yes, it's the rumors are true. I still do have North America's largest supply in my house. I have 3 cases of Club Mata left. Unfortunately, we are ordering another container. It will be in the U.S., I think, in 2 months' time. So somehow I have to, and that's why I said, okay, I have to stay in Europe enough and put, you know, more, you know, I have to flush the blood out of my Club Mate stream just so I can be productive and think about a lot of these different ideas. But the other point to that we can't underestimate, that we can't discount, is we shouldn't try to work ourselves too hard. That a lot of the abilities and things that we're coming up with and the impact that our information technologies have had on younger generations, we have to be wary of burning people out. That people who are seeing the new capabilities that are coming up are going to be tempted to use and abuse them, and we have to be very careful to find out what sorts of new kinds of play, you know, and new kinds of leisure activities and other different kinds of things we can do with the abilities that we're generating and not just purely use them for practical or purposeful ends. And I've come up with 42 points, and I believe, am I out of time as the next speaker here?
Well, sorry, I have one more point you might or might not take. Cool. It. Conspiracies will be more hard to construct. Transparency will raise, and more people will learn to understand reality as a complex collection of puzzle pieces. So that's changing reality as a point people see realities.
No, and I think that's a good way of putting together a lot of the points that I threw out here. And I believe I'm out of time. Thank you guys so much. It's been fun.